It's once again time for Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. My guest today is PMH Atwater. She is a researcher in the area of near-death phenomenon, and she's been doing so since 1978. We're going to be talking about this subject and also her book, The Big Book of Near-Death Experiences, The Ultimate Guide to What Happens When We Die. PMH Atwater is my guest, and your phone calls are welcome at 564-1290. This is Tell Me Your Story. It's coming right up.
Walk with me, talk with me, tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome to Tell Me Your Story. I actually have to stop and take a deep breath to calm myself down. I am just absolutely thrilled to be here. It is one of the most gorgeous days here on the central coast of Santa Barbara, California. And I was down at the chicken coop about an hour ago collecting some eggs for one of our neighbors to pick up from us and saying hello to some of the girls. That's right, I call them my girls. And we just have a great time. I cannot get over this whole, and maybe I don't ever want to get over it, this whole excitement of being here and being amongst the animals and nature and all of that wonderful thing, and then coming down and tying myself and wiring myself into all the technology to bring this program to you every Saturday at 3 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. We are also streaming on the internet live. Go to richarddugan.com, richarddugan.com, and click on the Listen Live link. I received an email from one of my sisters, I do have four of them, came from a big family, who said, you misspelled a word. And I thought, oh, no problem, fix the text. It was in one of the images, so I had to go back and completely recreate the image. Not a problem, because I keep templates. That's the way to do it, folks. And when you're working with computers, if you're doing redundancies, have a template. You can always go back to it. Well, today is a rather exciting day. We're going to be talking about black holes, and not the black holes that people are afraid of the super collider is going to create once they get it up and running again. Of course, they had to shut it down because the magnets, I guess, were overheating a little bit. It's an interesting concept, using magnets. And so they'll be firing that up, but people are afraid that it's going to create some kind of black hole or multiples thereof. And I was actually talking with my guest, PMH Atwater, and we were chatting about this, and it would at least be different than the black holes that we're dealing with in from a political nature, right? So welcome to the program.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'll tell you, I talked with you last night, and we chatted just for a few moments to confirm that we were ready to rock and roll, as it were, here on the program. And you were telling me that you were celebrating a birthday.
Yes, yesterday.
And it's really kind of exciting, and I was sharing with you that my mother just a couple of days earlier had shared, and you both kind of had the same kind of activities. You went out with the husband for dinner, and it was nice and calm and easy and exciting and fun.
We spent so much quality time together, and for the two of us, because we both work very long hours, and our week is a 6-day week, so you know, to have a half a day and a whole evening just to spend with each other was just the greatest gift of them all.
Well, I can certainly relate because I work 6 days a week as well, and Sundays are the days on which I choose to rest with my wife up on the hill. And if we get an inversion layer, a fog, they call it the marine layer, and it socks us in, even better. Love that. But we're going to be talking about an inversion that seems to take place in our lifetimes. Once again, going back to the black hole concept, that a lot of people are really afraid of. And it's not the one created by the super collider either. It's the darkness, the blackness, the void, the unknown when it comes to the process of transition that each one of us, they say, I don't know whether it's a social agreement or not, but they say that we're all going to do this transition, and many of us are just out of our minds scared. I don't want to die, and we run from it as if we could. It's as if we were going to run away from ourselves. You can't do that either. Have you, in your study and research over the last 30 years, felt that you've made a difference in that regard to help demystify it?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. Well, remember, I'm also an experiencer.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to get into that as well.
Yeah, in 1977, I died three times myself, and each time had a near-death experience, and each was different, although one seemed somehow to sort of flow into the next as if they were progressive. And it's because of my third near-death experience that I ever became a researcher. And back in those days, way back in those days, I was the new kid on the block. I'd never heard of Raymond Moody, never heard of Life After Life, his famous book. All I knew was that I had met Elizabeth Kubler-Ross at O'Hare Airport, just outside of Chicago. Her plane was late, and we had huddled together like a couple of girlish kids on a bench just chatting, and I told her about my three near-death experiences. She labeled me a near-death survivor and told me a little bit about the near-death experience, and that was it. She never mentioned Raymond Moody. And so, not knowing anything at all about the field, I went out and began my own independent work and didn't know about anybody else for a number of years later.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been one of those pioneers out there digging in the dirt, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
and I don't mean that unkindly, but I'm certainly a field worker. I am not a literature researcher. I'm not an academic. I'm not a scholar. I'm a person who gets out there and does the work. Has it made a difference? Well, what I can share with you is that tens of thousands, and that's no exaggeration in my case, tens of thousands of experiencers have expressed that my work saved their life. Certainly there's a lot of other researchers out there. They do good things. They do good work. But none of them really looked at the experience as I did, and certainly none of them ever searched and researched the after effects like I did. And that's, you really can't talk about the experience without talking about the after effects to the experience, because it's the after effects that validate it. And it's the after effects that are lifelong in most cases. And we're talking about physiological changes as well as psychological changes. And there's a pattern to them. And so when you really dig into the after effects and the cycles or phases of integration and how you handle it, you know, when we're talking about adults, when we're talking about children, then that opens up the kind of doors that most people don't want to enter. We're talking about heaven and hell. We're talking about suicide. We're talking about the way children are treated. We're talking about all kinds of things that have been pretty well skirted by the rest of the field. So I'm one of those kind of scrappy pioneers that says, wait a minute here, guys, there's another side to the story, and there's more and more and more. And, yeah, all these people have either contacted me or have put it in print or I heard about it. And that my work had saved their lives. And, you know, I just stop whenever I hear that, and it just, you know, it just fills me. It just fills my soul. It's just, you know, it's like that paid for the work.
Well, it seems to me that the process that we are all, again, heading toward is something that we really do need to understand. We started out talking a little bit about the super collider, and they want to understand the Big Bang. They want to understand how we started. And I'm sitting here going, well, what makes you think that it's a starting point? It's just a point. There had to have been something before the Big Bang, because you had to have something to make the Big Bang with.
Right.
You know, I think someone dropped a rock is what I think it was. It's just, you know.
Well, this is what we broach, of course, in near-death studies. And my latest book about that, The Big Book of Near-Death Experiences, is our first really good compendium. And I'm not saying really good because I wrote it, but I'm saying because it is such a vast compendium of the subject,
mm-hmm.
the after effects and the implications of the after effects. plus all the new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then my other little book, We Live Forever, The Real Truth About Death, really gets into the more personal things. You know, when death is in your lap, when someone you know is dying or you're dying, you're talking about the personal things, and that's what I get into in We Live Forever. And that DVD I made, a little CD DVD called As You Die.
Mm-hmm.
And we know today, because of the Catholic Church, they did a search on it, if you can imagine that, and found out that that either CD or DVD, you can get it in either format, As You Die, is the only such audio presentation in the world like it. And that's where I talk people through physical death as it is occurring and the separation of the soul.
That's something I'd like to discuss further as we continue here on the program. This is Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and my guest is PMH Atwater, and we're talking about transitioning near-death experiences. I actually have the copy of the Book of Near-Death Experiences here on the counter. I had to move a bunch of other stuff off to get the book up here because it is a rather large compendium. We'll continue talking with PMH Atwater as we continue our discussion. Give us a call, 564-1280 or 866-564-1290. That's AM 1290, and I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. Stay tuned. Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan. We're talking with the PMH Atwater, and we're going to find out what those initials stand for. It reminds me of the old MASH series where Hawkeye tried to find out what BJ stood for when it was BJ Honeycutt, and it was the letters B and the letter J. Well, we'll also find out more about transitioning and the big book of near-death experiences as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan. This program is available to you on the internet at richarddugan.com. Stay tuned. More coming up. This is Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. New paradigms for a new world. Views expressed are not necessarily those of the staff, management, ownership, or advertisers of this station. And we are here Monday, every Saturday. One day, maybe Monday through Friday. But Saturdays from 3 to 4 p.m. And we bring you this information to help you. To help you to move forward in your life. To release you from the fears and the anxieties when we talk of transition. When we talk about as you die, if you will, we want you to be able to transition fearlessly, if you will. And that's why we're talking with PMH Atwater, and we have just been conferring as far as our calendars. We have you coming back in November to continue this conversation as we have you here on the program. And in November, we're going to be talking about, obviously, a related subject, basically coming back to life. And so we'll talk about that at that time. Today we're going to be talking about the big book of near-death experiences and also As You Die. And you also mentioned the DVD, and you had a small book that you had mentioned at the beginning of the program as well.
We Live Forever.
And that's not just the title of the book. That's a truism.
Yes. We Live Forever, The Real Truth About Death. That is the most personal book I have yet written. It is dedicated to our granddaughter, who died at the age of 2, bacterial meningitis, seizing one day, dead the next. And she was the inspiration for me writing that book. I call it my little love book.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a book about life, and it's a book about death, and it's a book about the incredibleness that we are. Just how incredible we are as human beings, and our comings and our goings.
So when you had your experience, you said back in 1977, the triple header, so to speak.
I've never heard it called that before, but
well,
okay.
I'm sorry, I'm filled with baseball analogies. But it didn't scare you enough to say, I don't ever want to talk about this. This is not something I want to go into. It actually, was it intriguing to you?
It was certainly not scary. And very seldom do you hear of any near-death experiencer who was frightened by their experience. However, you do some. If it was a hellish experience or an unpleasant experience or a frightening experience, yes, those people will talk about having been scared or upset by what happened to them. But the vast majority have a more uplifting kind of experience, which I did. And, Yeah, no, I wasn't ever scared, but I'm going to have to say after the third one, I was left in a state of awesomeness. I was left in a state of overwhelmedness, like I can't really call it positive. I certainly can't call it negative. But it was unpleasant in the sense that I was so overwhelmed by it that it was over, I was left having to rediscover what a human being is.
It was sort of, it was like overloading your circuits.
Oh, it overloaded every circuit, and
yeah.
Yes.
And that's
way overloaded.
That's a concern in regards to a lot of folks involved in the spiritual life and metaphysics, because they know there's so much information out there, but they also know, too, that they can't take it all in quickly, because it's got to be gradual, because the human being, the physical body and the brain and the mind can't handle it. It'll I've even heard the concept, and it's a little bizarre, and thank God it didn't happen to you, you can fry your brain. There's too much information coming in, and it will just fry.
And that does happen to some near-death experiencers. That certainly is very common in the field of spirituality, mysticism, transformations of consciousness. You can get too much too soon, especially if you're going after the Kundalini effect and having a Kundalini breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
You really need to know what you're doing to be trained or have a mentor or someone around that can help you work your way through it. Because indeed you can go too far, farther than what you are able to integrate or understand or that your body can even physically handle.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're talking about near-death experiences, we're talking about all of that happening at once, in a few minutes or a few hours or overnight. So you're getting all of this at once. And this is why I truly feel that the after effects can sometimes be very challenging to integrate. The experience itself, to integrate, the after effects to handle, and many times, people are really overextended in integrating and handling these kinds of experiences.
You have put together this unbelievable compendium that I've only been able to scan through.
Well, I hope you tell everybody how much fun it is, because it's full of sidebars and cartoons and pictures. And it's written for the everyday person. Busy people on the go.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, and again, that's the whole point of why we're talking about this, because we want people to think of it in the context of fun. I mean, I use the analogy of a car in that in my driving history, I have owned four cars. Okay? But
mm-hmm.
I still get from point A to point B, even though I change vehicles every so often for whatever reason. It doesn't matter what the reason. The fact is that we do that. That's what transitioning is.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yes.
So when you had this experience, they were plural, actually, again.
Yeah, that's right.
It again, was overwhelming. It was an overload of sorts. And once you were able to process this, in 1978, it was really when you sort of officially began your research into this area. And again, you were new at it. You were because there was nobody else really doing this. How were you able to pursue this research where people took you seriously?
Well, I'm a cop's kid. I was raised in a police station, and my dad started teaching me police investigative techniques at the ripe old age of 9 years old. So I grew up with it.
Mm-hmm.
He was very insistent in my training. For instance, we would be at the dime stores. I come from Twin Falls, Idaho. I'm a Westerner by birth. So we would go in the dime stores in Twin Falls, Idaho. And in those days, you go into a store like that, and everything was not shelved. I mean, they didn't use shelves. Everything was eye level, covered with glass. So I'm walking in, and I'm looking at all of these goodies like any little kid, and I'm agog at the glitter, and the MO is always the same. Dad would twirl me around, look at me eyeball to eyeball, and say, all right, now describe that man that just went by. And there would be a checklist. You know, what's the color of his hair? Is he wearing a part? Describe his clothing. Is there a watch? Is there a belt? Is the shoes, the socks, any distinguishing features, so forth and so on. All this very long, detailed checklist. Or we'd be crossing the street in downtown Twin Falls at Shoshone in Maine. We'd get safely across the street. Dad would twirl me around, same MO. All right, now describe that woman that just went by. He did this off and on for 3 years. I never knew when he was going to do it. So I got to the point where I was just staring at everybody and looking and remembering. I really think my dad was trying to raise the world's most perfect witness, because he was very upset. It really troubled him if, let's say, for instance, there was an accident and there were four witnesses. Each of the witnesses would have a different story. And that just drove him nuts. So I really think, I really think he was trying to raise a good witness. But that's what I fell back on. That's what I used. And it's a very thorough, extremely thorough way to do your work. But you do not use leading questions. Let's say, for instance, we're back at that automobile accident. You cannot go up to the audience or the witness and say, what did you see that car do? Because you said the word car. All you can say is, what did you see?
Mm-hmm.
And then if the person says car, then you can say car.
Mm-hmm.
You can't use words in advance of the witness or the experiencer.
So as soon as the concept's kind of like in a court of law, that if one side opens the door to a concept, a particular area of questioning, then the other side can pursue it. But until the first side opens the door, you can't do it.
And also, if you are doing good police investigative work, you are studying the individual.
Mm-hmm.
You are watching their body language. You are watching what they do with their eyes and their shoulders and their arms and their hands and their knees. And, you know, you're studying that individual. And you're also studying, if anybody else walks by, does that change the individual? Does that change the intonation of their voice? Does that change their word use? So you're always studying. And when I would be through with that, whenever I could, I would meet with and have sessions also with significant others, with neighbors, with healthcare providers, with the boss, anyone and everyone that I could meet with, I would. So I was always checking, 360-degree checking, and I did that with my people as much as I could. All over the United States, or as much in the United States as I could, different times, different people, different places, to check on, okay, how about culturalisms? Does that make any difference? Does age make any difference? Does intelligence make any difference? You know, and whenever I could, I would ask them to draw what happened to them. Or, you know, draw me pictures about your experience. So it became a very long, thorough road to hoe, and, you know, nobody's paying you. You're an independent person. There's no grant. So I would work at whatever jobs I could to pay for my research. And then you publish your papers, you write your books, you get it out there. I'm 9 books out now on my findings. Working on my 10th one now, which will be my final research book on this subject, and completing my theoretical model. And, yeah, it's been a long haul,
mm-hmm.
but it's because of my third near-death experience. I was told to do the work I am doing and have done. And You know, that's why I'm alive, is to do the work, literally.
Well, and we've had other near-death experiencers on the program in the past, and I've asked them this question, and I'll ask you, and that is, whether it was the first, second, or the third, wasn't there a point during that experience that it was like, I don't want to go back. I like it here. I'm going to end up here anyway, so why don't
I
just stay?
Absolutely. Most experiencers feel that way. That's commonplace.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, indeed, that's very true.
But the universe doesn't seem to use guilt as a, you better go back or people are going to miss you or you're not going to get the work done.
Well, in the first one, I flipped back. In the second one, I chose to come back. In the third one, I came back with a mission.
Okay.
And that mission was very specific and very detailed. And I knew what I was to do. And that's all there was to that. I just came back fully infused, utterly passionate about my mission because I was told by what I call the voice like none other, quote, test revelation. You are to do the research. One book for each death. I was shown what that meant. Book one was not named. Books two and three were named. I was told what was to be in each book, but not how to do it or how long it would take me.
Mm-hmm.
And so my job was specific, and I just had this very clear sense that there was no choice.
Right.
It was a given.
So obviously the universe uses a different kind of math because you're telling us you're finishing up your 10th book, and they told you to write three. So the other seven were just on a whim on your part?
Well,
I just throw those in as
there were three specific books, Richard. I really consider coming back to life book one.
Mm-hmm.
But because of publishing difficulties, I have to now call it the prelude.
Ah, okay.
And Beyond the Light is book one. Book two is Future Memory, which I did indeed write. And book three is a specific type of manual that is a quarter done. It sits on my desk. I don't know if it ever will be done. I'm willing now to release it, and we'll see what the universe has to say. But all of the books I have written, not one of them have I ever decided to write or planned to write. Not one single one. They all came to me in sparkles of light and literally plopped down on my desk and revealed themselves to me. And then I went into prayer and meditation to see if should I do this or not. Is it appropriate? If it was, then I would go ahead with it. And that's when I would do the outline. And that's when, you know, you begin your discipline and you do your work. But the initial, no, all of my books came to me. I did not go to them, and I did not decide to write a single one of them.
Interesting. By the way, the website, if you're interested, is pmhatwater.com. That's pmhatwater.com. And you can check out nine of her 10 books. She's still working on the 10th one.
Well, I've written a lot of books,
mm-hmm.
but on the near-death experience.
On the near-death experience. And I wanted to dive into another area as we continue talking here on Tell Me Your Story that we're going to get into in the next segment, and that has to do with your perceptions before and after your near-death experiences, and even let's include even the research that you have done as to your perceptions, your understandings and awareness of spirituality and the spirit world as it pertains to this whole process. And we're going to do that as we come back talking with PMH Atwater here on Tell Me Your Story. RichardDugan.com is my website. This program will be available following this broadcast, and you can also listen live online at richarddugan.com. That's richarddugan.com. Want you to stay right where you are. We have more to come. We still have plenty of program left, and if you've got a question, give us a call. 564-1290. That's 564-1290 or 866-564-1290. This is Tell Me Your Story. My name is Richard Dugan, and you're listening to a program about near-death experiences, about spirituality, and I have a big question that's sitting on hold for PMH Atwater having to do with her perceptions of spirituality. We're going to talk about that. Stay with us. This is Tell Me Your Story, and you can call in with your comments and questions as well, 564-1290 or 866-564-1290. Don't go away. There is more to come. This is Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and we're talking with PMH Atwater, and we're talking about near-death experiences as well as spirituality. And I'm going to reform the question for you so that I can have you answer that. We have plenty of time for you to expound on it before we wrap up the program. The question basically deals with spirituality, about not just in terms of quote-unquote the afterlife, because certainly that's the way we view it as far as transitioning or dying. But tell me about how you viewed your spirituality, your not your religious life, because we all had that, and there's a difference. We've all kind of understand. We understand what the difference is between that and spirituality and the spirit life. What was your perception before and after your near-death experience, and even before and after you began this research? How has it changed?
Okay, let's talk about before. Before my experience, long before my experience, I got into altered states of consciousness, mysticism, psychic phenomenon, and all of those kinds of things. I got into them in a very, very big way because I was very curious, and because I wanted to know how things worked. I wanted to know what it was, and I wanted to know how it worked. So I started Idaho's first nonprofit metaphysical corporation called Inner Forum, and I dealt with people by the thousands, did for year after year after year. We conducted all kinds of experiments and had all kinds of experiences. Brought in all kinds of speakers, started the first Northwest Speakers Bureau, and I was editor of a little mini magazine called Inner Forum, and did a lot of research for Brad Steiger. I was very, very, very active, brought in a lot of people, and really felt that I had reached a point in my own life where a lot of things made sense. I could see how it worked. It had changed my life very much for the better. I was a better mother. I was a better wife. I was a better human being. I was then employed as a professional writer for the Idaho Department of Commerce and Development. It's no longer called that, but it was then.
Mm-hmm.
And just did. I mean, I never did anything small, Richard. It was always big or, you know, I didn't do it. So I did everything in a very, very big way. And I was really, really humbled by it, excited by it, happy with it all. Until one day when I came to realize that I really didn't know what I was doing. That I really did not understand love as I thought I did. I really didn't understand spirituality as I thought I did. I really was not where I thought I was at all in my own spiritual journey. And I had this feeling, this sense, as we all do from time to time, when the student is ready, the teacher will come. And I felt like I needed another teacher. I needed to go deeper, much deeper, because I was not deep enough. And I really felt that fully to the tips of my toes, to the bottom of my soul, that there needed to be something else or something more. And I was expecting a person, i.e. teacher. I did not realize that I would indeed get a teacher, but that teacher was called death. And I died three times. And all of my background only made two differences. It enabled me to be in very unusual or different environments and not be troubled by that or frightened. And it enabled me to exist without an ego. Didn't need an ego. Other than that, I was just as traumatized and just as impacted as any other experiencer was. It took my life and turned it upside down. And when it was over, I had to relearn how to crawl, how to stand, how to tell the difference between left and right, how to see properly, hear properly, and rebuild all of my belief systems. I had to begin, as a baby does, at ground zero, and start all over again, and redefine myself, and redefine life, and redefine everything. And when I say everything, I mean just that. I was throwing out pots and pans and sheets because I didn't know what they were, and I couldn't really prove what they were, so I had to find out. I would even go to a laboratory. Well, first of all, I sent off to the major makers of pots and pans in the United States. I sent off for their manufacturing specs and metallurgical reports, and then I took it to a laboratory and had it tested. And from that, I decided what kind of pots and pans I would allow in my house. And I did that with everything. I did that with soap. I did that with sheets. I did that with clothes. I did that with every single thing you can think of. I even did it with the idea of motherhood. What is motherhood? What are children? What is this world? What is love? Did it all over again. And, you know, when we're talking about near-death experiences, we get into the light show without considering what the individual goes through. And most of these near-death experiences come from trauma or violence. And you're dealing with rebuilding a body as well as your life. And that's what I was doing, rebuilding a body as well as my life. And it took a lot of doing before I could finally get to that place where I could at least recognize myself to be myself. And that moment came in Seattle, Washington, at the Mind Miraculous Symposium that was held the first week of November in 1977. And my doctor and friends of mine had me trucked up there in a van with my friends, and I attended that because I had to take a lot of medication before I was perky and human again. I attended that symposium, and the first speaker did it. That speaker was Dr. William Tiller, and he's a physicist from Stanford, and he talked about what he called the eternal now, that all things happen in the same space at the same time. And he felt he could prove that with a particular chart that he flipped on to this gigantic stage in the Opera House of Seattle Center. And he felt that that would show how this could be. And the image he flashed up on that screen was exactly what I had seen and experienced and witnessed during my third near-death experience. And I jumped up out of my chair, and I ran out into the lobby, and I collapsed under a light, crying and sobbing. He saw it too. I'm not crazy. I'm not crazy. He saw it too. And it was that moment that showed me that I could rebuild my life and my world, and I did. But it took that moment to where I could see that I wasn't crazy. It took that moment to open the door for me where I could appreciate who I am now and how I operate now, that I can feel comfortable knowing and seeing and hearing that everything is alive. Absolutely everything is alive. I don't care whether it's animate or inanimate. It all moves. It all has an aura. It all has an intelligence. And it's all alive. And it can speak to you, and you can speak to it. It took that experience to show me that in that aliveness, I truly am a child of God, just like you and everybody else, that I truly am a divine being. It took that experience to help me see through what other people call the world and realize that what I was seeing was God looking at itself.
Wow. It's something that, as I hear these words coming out, it makes me think of the concept of the eternal now, the tire on the roadway, and there's only a small portion of that tire that's touching it, if you're looking at it from a cross-section, that's touching the road at any given moment. That's the now moment, and yet it's eternal.
Yeah, and everything is holy.
Yeah.
You know, my husband and I have been married 28 years, and I can tell you that just to sit in the same room with that man is like sitting with God. Just to touch his skin is like a communion with holiness. And I feel this way about so many things, especially him. But, you know, just being alive is the greatest privilege I think a person could have.
Wow. That is, I'm going to have to go back and listen to the program when when we're done to re-listen to this story, because there's just so much there. It's just remarkable, and yet you continue your study and your research and your investigation. And
I'm doing my job.
Yeah,
this is what the voice asked me to do, and this is what I'm doing.
And it's rather fascinating to me that your father taught you the things that he did so that you could then literally be able to write down this information as you experienced it, as you saw it, as you felt it, as you heard it, as you...
And just do the work.
And just do the work.
As a good cop on the beat. You know, people call me the gumshoe of near death. Well, that's what I am.
The PI of any, of near... of ND.
It makes life more fun. I don't want to kid anybody here on research. That's been a lot of hard work.
Sure.
My work has not been appreciated. There's been a lot of attacks. There's been a lot of problems. But after 3 years of that, I can now stand on my own two feet because some of my work has now been verified in clinical studies, especially the big Dutch study, that prospective study.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know I'm in Lancet Medical Journal? Some of my work is in Lancet Medical Journal.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah.
That's very impressive.
That look up December 15, 2001. I tell everybody I got an Oscar for Christmas.
I like that. PMH Atwater is my guest, and we're talking about spirituality as well as the connection that we have with the other side, if you will. And I guess the hereafter isn't really the hereafter. I think that, and I'm wondering too if people are starting to, because once a word is charged with a particular type of energy, it's very difficult to discharge it and recharge it with a new type of energy. So death and dying and passing away, they all have that same ick. We don't want to talk about that. Like, we don't want to talk about life insurance kind of thing. It used to be years ago. I don't want to talk
about it. My research base is nearly 4,000 adult and child experiencers.
Sure.
And the number one thing that most of these experiencers say is four words. Just four words.
Just four words.
Four words.
Yeah.
Always there is life. Now, if you hang on that for a minute, always there is life, that means there is no afterlife. That means there is no before life. That means there is no present life. That means that always, at some level, in some realm, in some space, in some body, always you are alive. That means that forever can be counted on.
We are going to leave our listeners pondering that until next time we meet on the 15th of November. And hopefully we'll have some folks who will share with us their experiences as we have you back again on in November as we head towards those wonderful holidays and that celebration of the Oscar that you received in 2001. Well, PMH Atwater, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you on the program, and I thank you so much for the research that you have provided us to have access to, and we look forward to having you back in November.
Thank you.
And if you'll stay on the line, we'll chat just a few moments before we wrap up our program here. I want to remind you, next week's program is coming up, and it's coming up in about 7 days or 6 days and so many hours. We're going to be talking with the author of Ark of the Covenant and the Holy Grail, the symbolism behind the mystery. We'll talk about that and other issues. My guest is the author, and her name is Henrietta Bernstein, and we'll be talking about this fascinating subject of the symbols that are out there and how they make a difference. They absolutely do. If they didn't, we wouldn't be focused on them, folks. So we'll be talking about that. And the new paradigms for a new world. This is Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan. Love to all, and have a great weekend.